The collateral cost of high-speed trading. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. It's December 4th. Hey, everybody. Are high-speed computer traders costing you, me, mom-and-pop investor money? Also, is a renewable energy boom on the way in Africa? And the new movie technology that's being rolled out next week with The Hobbit. Why you might love it or hate it.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Recent episodes of erratic market behavior, like the flash crash, if you remember that, have given plenty of reasons for concern about high-speed computer trading. Now, a new study also finds high-speed trading is costing average investors, those of us you might call slow speed, I guess. The report concludes that in some cases, fast computers are skimming several dollars off the top of nearly every trade made by retail investors. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
The trading might happen lightning fast, but tracking the money that's generated in these automated transactions has taken a lot longer. Dennis Kelleher heads Better Markets, a group that advocates Wall Street reforms. He says these findings are long overdue because high-frequency traders have been concealing the data for years.
The HFT firms are in the business of profit protection, not market protection.
Those firms have long argued they've created a flood of new trading that's helped push down trading costs for all investors. But at Seaport Securities, Wall Street broker Ted Weisberg suggests you get what you pay for. You might save on trading commissions, but end up losing if there's no one looking out for your interests.
The high-frequency trader has, in some sense, replaced the dealer, and they are simply, in my opinion, gaming the system at the expense of the public.
Weisberg says that's because computers can jump ahead of your trade in the blink of an eye and make a quick profit at your expense. The new study finds small investors could be losing as much as $5 per trade to high-speed computers. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
And let's do the numbers. Well, it's been a mixed morning all morning long here, and so it is at this very moment. The Dow, in fact, is flat, sitting at 12,966. The S&P 500, good measure of the broader market, is down about 0.25%. And the NASDAQ is down about 0.5%. After the closing bell today, we'll get earnings from Pandora. Going to be looking at how many people are listening, how long they're listening. But the company's outlook could also well hang on a bill in Congress that would lower the royalties paid by internet radio stations. U.S. regulators are suing the China-based operations of four accounting firms for allegedly blocking fraud investigations. My colleague Stacey Vanek Smith is filling in on the morning report today. And earlier, she caught up with reporter Andrew Wood, who is in Hong Kong, to talk about it. Here's Stacey.
Andrew, walk us through this case. Who's involved and what is it that the Securities and Exchange Commission is alleging here?
Well, the companies involved are some of the biggest accounting firms in the world, companies like PricewaterhouseCoopers and Ernst & Young. Now, they're caught in a difficult place. The American regulators, the Securities and Exchange Commission, under the law, can demand information, audit information, on any company that's listed on American stock markets. And the SEC is investigating about 9 mainland Chinese companies at the moment on suspicion that they might have defrauded investors in the United States by issuing false financial information. Now, the Chinese affiliates of some of these big accounting firms are also bound by Chinese law. And Chinese law says that some of these companies can declare their financial records as state secrets. And of course, state secrets are not to be revealed to foreigners.
Does this have any implication for the ability of American companies to do business in China?
It's not a really big issue between Beijing and Washington. But of course, this does sort of raise a lot of questions about mainland Chinese companies listing on American stock markets. Listing in America is a lot more prestigious than listing in, say, Shanghai or Shenzhen or even Hong Kong. And there's a much bigger market for their shares. But you know, there's been plenty of allegations against Chinese companies that their accounting standards are just not high enough. And I think that this we might see a sort of mass exodus of Chinese companies from American stock markets as a result.
Reporter Andrew Wood in Hong Kong. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
When The Hobbit comes out next Friday, it'll be the first major outing for a new movie technology. It's the first major studio movie to be shot at 48 frames per second. when fans got their first look at a clip from The Hobbit this summer at one of the Comic-Con events, I believe. Many were stunned by it, and not necessarily in a good way. Now critics are getting their first look at the entire movie in the new format, and one of those folks is Matt Patches. He's movie editor at Hollywood.com. Good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, explain the technology to me. 48 FPS, or 48 frames per second. What is it?
Well, basically every movie that we see shot on film is shot in 24 frames per second. So as it goes by, it registers in our eyes, and we're used to that. That's how we've been watching films for, 100 years. Peter Jackson, the director of The Hobbit, has been a big advocate for upping that frame rate to create more realism in his mind. So he shot The Hobbit in 48 frames per second, thinking that it would be more realistic. We'll have more visual information kind of flooding our eyes and our brains as we're watching this movie.
So what was it like watching The Hobbit this way?
Well, it was a completely different movie-going experience for me. The people who saw this movie or clips of it early on thought that the 48 frames per second looked a lot like an old BBC television show, or maybe when you're watching an HD television that hasn't been calibrated correctly for 120 hertz. It gets that soap opera-y effect. And you know what? The movie kind of does have that effect at times. Where it really works, it's, when you have two actors talking side by side, these dwarves and this hobbit Bilbo Baggins, they feel like real people. And that's kind of extraordinary. Where it doesn't work so much is when they step onto this amazing landscape and it looks more like a set. It's a very strange effect.
How would you predict this is going to go over with moviegoers?
Well, my big worry is that they're promoting 48 frames per second as HFR. Like when you go to buy tickets online, you'll see The Hobbit or The Hobbit 3D or The Hobbit 3D HFR. And if you don't know, you might enter this movie and then see this new technology and not get what you're expecting. That's my biggest fear. I would recommend people check it out because it's such an innovative experiment. It's a big risk, but it makes the 3D work. It makes it so much clearer and colorful than the 3D we're used to. And it makes the CG characters really realistic. I mean, we've seen Gollum in the past Lord of the Rings trilogy, but here he's just as real as the human actors, which blew me away. It's only when these big action scenes happen that you start realizing, oh, hey, this is being shot in a totally different way, and now it's reminding me of that, which is a little distracting.
Matt Patches is movie editor at Hollywood.com. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Speaking of movies, I'll get around to making good on that segue in a minute here. With a second term coming, President Obama is considering some new ambassadorial appointments, including most likely a few plum posts for big campaign donors. It's not just him. That happens with just about every president, I think. Bloomberg News this morning is reporting on one of the more intriguing possibilities. The editor-in-chief of Vogue, Anna Wintour, is in the running to be the next U.S. ambassador to France, or maybe more likely the U.K. That notion's a little controversial. She's somewhat lacking in formal foreign policy experience. And if you have seen the movie or if you have read the novel, The Devil Wears Prada, which was based on Wintour, you know that while she's regarded as extremely capable, diplomatic might not be the first word to come to mind.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Today, the British company Blue Energy unveiled plans for what would be the largest solar power plant in Africa, and it would be something like the fourth largest in the world. Construction will begin next year in Ghana. It would increase that country's electricity capacity by 6%. So is this the leading edge of a trend? Ensgar Kina is coordinator of the African Renewable Energy Alliance, and he's with me now from Kenya. Good to talk with you.
Hello.
So tell me first about the need for energy and electricity in Africa.
There's a huge lack of underserved need for access to electricity on the continent, which is a huge business opportunity, if you like, because people currently say that about 650 million people on the African continent do not have access to electricity, and that, of course, is a huge burden to any sustainable development.
What are the specific kinds of renewable energy that are most available for people in Africa?
Right. The northern and the southern part of the continent of Africa really bears a huge potential for solar energy because we have ideal solar radiation. In the middle of the continent, we have a huge potential in hydropower as well as biomass. And then, of course, there's a huge potential for on and offshore wind in the different regions of Africa as well.
So with all that available, why isn't Africa covered coast to coast and top to bottom with renewable energy extraction?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that's partly due to our legacy that extending the electricity grid to the communities is very, very costly. So now that the renewable energy technologies are mature, the African communities have now the opportunity to utilize the mature technologies in a decentralized manner. The policymakers that we are advising are more and more engaged in putting supportive framework in place because the biggest barrier for businesses, for private sector to strive is the lack of provision with reliable electricity.
And this solar project in Ghana is certainly a very good example of that. Enskar Kina is director of the Africa Office of the World Future Council Foundation, also coordinator of the African Renewable Energy Alliance. Very good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Today, representatives of the National Hockey League and the Players Association sit down again to try to resolve their labor dispute. The NHL lockout has already cost about a third of the hockey season. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains what is keeping them apart.
Hockey players have been getting about 57% of the league's revenues. Owners want to split it 50-50. The two sides will meet today without their lead negotiators. Paul Swangard directs the Warsaw Sports Marketing Center at the University of Oregon.
If these two organizations can strip away the negotiators for one day at least and allow the two sides to come together in a less adversarial tone, maybe something out of that will be a catalyst to get a deal done.
The hockey players are mostly millionaires. The owners are mostly billionaires. But they aren't the biggest losers when games are canceled, says Scott Rosner. He follows the business of sports at the Wharton School.
It's the waiter, the waitress, the vendor who relies on game day money to make ends meet that really are the ones that are most impacted by this.
Workers dependent on hockey hope they won't see a repeat of what happened 8 years ago. Back then, another labor dispute resulted in the cancellation of the entire hockey season. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
I know folks who live in the Midwest, at least, are very familiar with the trouble with ash trees, and they're having some trouble of their own over in Europe. A fungal disease that has infected most of the ash trees in Denmark has now put a wide swath of British woodland in jeopardy. The financial and environmental repercussions of this could be dire, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Like the rustling in the undergrowth of an English wood, the first lawsuit of the crisis is stirring. Simon Ellis, a commercial tree farmer, is suing the government over its ban on the movement of ash trees.
We invest in these crops during the summer months and harvest at this time of year. And by imposing the restrictions they've put on us now, that's stopped our income stream before it's even started.
A third of Britain's woodland is at risk. The cost to landowners and tree growers could run into the tens of millions. Simon Ellis blames the government for failing 3 years ago to take heed of the ash tree epidemic in Denmark. Tim Briarcliffe speaks for commercial tree growers in Britain.
We wrote to the government and said, we've seen this terrible disease in Denmark and you need to ban imports now to stop the disease coming into the UK.
That was in 2009. The government finally imposed its import ban 2 weeks ago.
So here we are today with the disease in the country.
The government says there was no scientific evidence 3 years ago that the disease was in Britain, and so under EU trade rules, ash imports could not be banned then. Environment Minister Rupert Ponsonby.
The first confirmed finding in the country was in March of this year, and since then we have taken action to put in place a ban on movements and imports.
Too little, too late, say the critics, as the disease spreads like wildfire across Britain. Now the race is on in plant laboratories to find a cure. Environmental campaigner George Monbiot is not optimistic about the future of one of Britain's best-loved trees.
It is too late. It's going to destroy the majority of Britain's ash trees. That seems absolutely clear. We're losing a part of ourselves as well as a part of the natural world.
The cost may run into millions, the loss to the landscape incalculable. In rural England, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And finally, last week we talked with the CEO of iRobot. You know, they make the Roomba, and we talked, among other things, about robotics jobs. And one of the things that always comes up when you're talking about robots is, will they take over my job? Robots have put plenty of people out of work, but now they're taking the jobs of some hard-working dolphins. For years, the Navy has trained dolphins to hunt down mines in the ocean. But now, according to the San Diego Union-Tribune, which is where the Dolphin Squadron is based, I don't know if they call them a squadron, but I'm calling them a squadron, near San Diego, a torpedo-shaped robot can now do the job of finding those mines just about as well as dolphins and without the 7 years of dolphin training. The 20 affected dolphins will not need to apply for unemployment benefits, so don't worry. Like other military folks whose jobs become obsolete, the dolphins will be reassigned. I'm Jeff Horwich, and that is all for the Marketplace Midday Update. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.